Okay, we're back, and I'm going to introduce Vin Cerf, and I asked him if there's anything particularly he wanted to say, and he said, make it brief. So, Vin Cerf, I'll be in that interview.
I always get nervous when people clap before you said anything. The first reaction is you should sit down, because it won't get any better than that. First of all, thank you very much for organizing this. These topics are very important to all of us, and I hope that we'll take advantage of this time and have some good substantive discussion. I wanted to remind you that June of 1991 was when it was announced that the Internet Society would be formed in January of the following year. It was in Copenhagen, and it was a rainy day, but the host assured me that statistically it was a nice day in Copenhagen. So the organization is approaching its 20th year. I also wanted to acknowledge Lynn Senhor's leadership. The organization has changed in dramatic ways in terms of its scope, stability, its visibility, and I think a lot of that's very much due to Lynn Senhor. I want to publicly thank you for all the work. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to try to bring some additional substance to the discussion. The question was, what kind of an internet do you want? And so I'd like to talk a little bit about the kind of internet I want and hope for. One thing is that it is open, as it has been so much so in the past. The standards have been open. There are minimal constraints on the use of those standards. Open source has become an important part of that whole process. It's expandable, and of course, I have to remind everyone here that it's time to implement IPv6. If you haven't done that, please do so, so we can keep growing the network. It's not going to stop working, but it won't grow if we don't have enough address space. So it should be completely obvious that we need to implement V6 in parallel with V4. And by the way, for those of you who have in mind the sort of a switch that you flip to go from V4 to V6, let me say that we don't have that opportunity anymore. When we went from the NCP to TCP, there were only 400 computers on the band. And we had a lot of leverage to get people to switch to the internet protocols by telling them that if they didn't switch, we wouldn't fund their research in the following year. It was very persuasive. There are over 800 million machines that are on the physical public internet right now, so we can't play that game. So that means when you build devices that are intended to be internet capable, they have to be able to do either V4 or V6 or both at the same time. And the reason, especially if this device moves around, not only with mobile, this device you physically carry, it could end up in a location where either V4 only is available or V6 only is available, or both are available, and they need to operate both at the same time. Another element of open, which has come up repeatedly today, is the idea of being able to access virtually all services that are available on the global internet without discrimination. And I think this is a very important principle to try to maintain. We have an expectation that when you get onto the internet, you should be able to reach virtually any termination point on the network. Now, we have to accept that there are going to be some exceptions. For example, in the case of an enterprise, it might not want to have all of its facilities equally available. And that's not an unreasonable position to take. That's what firewalls are all about. But in principle, all those termination points that wish to be reachable should be reachable. We put it that way. Users should have competitive choice where that's possible if the economics are with us. Having more than one option, either for getting access to the internet or for acquiring equipment to use the internet, is a very important part of that story.
The freedom to speak and the freedom to hear, I suggest to you, those are not the same. Are very important. The fact that you can speak doesn't necessarily mean that anybody can hear you. And so it's necessary that we have both of those freedoms properly accounted for. Of course, I want an internet that's affordable, and this turns out to be very important because as the capability extends further into the world, we're only about 28% penetrated now, It is reaching places with very different economic conditions than the places where the internet started, where economic conditions were conducive to its implementation. So as we reach further and further in the world, it's more and more important to get the cost down. One of the reasons that mobile has been so effective at penetrating in the world is that the costs actually have been substantially less than wireline costs would have been in order to provide connectivity. And of course, the equipment itself is getting less and less expensive over time. The internet also, the one I want, it has to be accessible. And what I mean by this in part is that language should not be a barrier. Internationalized domain names are an example of a kind of accessibility that I hope we will see more of. But those who have various disabilities, like I have, I'm hearing impaired, would like an internet that is accommodating in that regard, whether the disability is vision or hearing or mobility or other difficulty. We'd like an internet that accommodates this kind of accessibility. I'd like it to be a broadband internet. Now, broadband is something which is defined in various and sundry ways, but usually it means faster than whatever you can get now. Really, that does seem to be the case, because there was a time when broadband was thought of as 200,000 bits per second. Now, I honestly remember when the first 1200 baud modem came out, I thought, my God, I won't need anything faster than that. I can't read faster than that. And of course, it didn't take long to realize that it wasn't just human beings reading text that was important on the net. It was imagery and video and eventually machines talking to machines. So broadband is important, both wired and wireless. Our appetites for the use of bandwidth simply increase over time. I want an internet that preserves privacy. I want an internet that's capable of providing confidentiality. I want an internet that allows anonymity, but I won't argue necessarily that it has to be absolute. And we'll come back to that when we talk about safety on the internet. But there are plenty of instances in which anonymity should be possible. You should be able to get to and are often offered access to the internet in public facilities like libraries, where you don't necessarily have to identify yourself. And it was already been mentioned several times in the early proceedings today that there are cases where anonymity is, in fact, vital to life. That loss of anonymity could be equated to potential loss of life, or at least imprisonment or other kinds of pretty serious consequences. And yet there are times when those anonymous voices need to be heard. Now, I will also admit to you that speaking anonymously sometimes invites a lot of harmful speech as well, and so somehow or other we have to find an appropriate balance to deal with the extremes of anonymity. I would think also that I want an internet which is transparent and gives me some control over that which I want to keep private. I don't want to feel that in order to keep things private, I have to completely avoid using the internet. That would be a disappointing outcome. And so understanding what methods are available to me to keep things private, what things are being tracked, for example, can I tell what is known about my use of the network? Do I have any control over that? Or questions that I hope that I would have the ability to answer. But I want to focus on the remaining time here about an internet that's safe. And I think that here we have a real challenge. Freedom from harm is not an easy thing to implement. And yet I think most people who use the internet would like to think that it's safe to do so. So how can we achieve that? Well, there might be some specific technical methods that would be helpful. For example, using strong authenticity, using cryptographic methods for authentication, can be a very powerful tool. But I want to emphasize very strongly that there's a difference between identifiers and identity. I want to distinguish between those two concepts. An identifier is simply a string of characters. It doesn't they do not necessarily mean anything. Identity is what you and I are. It's our names. It's our birthdays. It's our domiciles. It's where we work and so on. It's a complex of information about us as individuals. I think it'd be very powerful if we could assume that in the internet you could strongly authenticate an identifier and simply say, hi, my name is Vint. You don't know who Vint is. You have no idea who Vint is, but here is my identifier, and I can strongly authenticate that. And the party on the other end should be able to say, okay, please execute your strong authenticity. And I would say, well, here's my public key. And they'll say, well, if that's your public key, then I should be able to encrypt a message to you in the public key, and you should be able to decrypt it. So that party sends me a random number encrypted in my public key. I decrypt it, and that party might say, please send me the response of that random number in my encrypted in my public key. So you could do an exchange which simply assures both parties that you both have operating public and private key pairs. That's all you've done. But what that allows you to do is the next time this individual approaches you or the next time you approach them, say, hi, I'm Vint, they'll say, well, if you're Vint, then you still have a functioning public and private key pair. Please decrypt this new random challenge. I can establish that I'm the same Vint that communicated before. Now, this is assuming I haven't had my private key compromised. Why am I going into all this detail? It's to persuade you that you can build on top of this notion of strong identifier, strongly authenticated identifier, to build up to, but not necessarily require, the notion of strong identity. I could then associate an identity with that identifier if I choose to do so. So I want an internet that allows for anonymity, that allows for strong authenticity of identifiers, and if on demand, allows for strong identity. So let me give you an example. Suppose that I come to you after having, we've had these exchanges, you know me as Vint, you know I can repeatedly authenticate myself as Vint, and I say I'd like to borrow $50,000. The natural response might be either buzz off or I need to know a little more about you. I need to know you as a person. I need to know something about your finances. Do you have a job? Do you have any collateral? And I might respond, and all of this could be encrypted so it would be confidential. I might respond and say, I work here, this is my income, and so on. Of course, this party, whom I've just asked for $50,000 from, doesn't necessarily know whether I'm telling the truth. So that party needs to be able to take the information that I provided and go to some other trusted third party to validate the information that I have offered. I could have voluntarily gone to such a trusted third party and provided that information and asked them to validate my information if they are requested to do so. And I realize there's a kind of infinite regression here. Do I trust the trusted third party and so on? I submit to you that we have faced this problem before in other domains, and we've succeeded in finding people who are trusted to vouch for your bona fides. Sometimes there's more than one. There are the credit companies and so on. So the idea here is we should be able to build up a system of authentication and trust and identity, but only invoked as it's needed. I certainly don't think it's necessary to have a driver's license, so to speak, an internet driver's license, and to identify yourself every time you use the internet. I think that would be remarkably inhibiting. Well, we're on the subject here of safety and strong authenticity. I'm a big believer in two-factor authentication. I'm not a big believer in reusable passwords. These have been too easily compromised. We see the results of that every day. And so having the ability to use cryptographic means to strongly authenticate yourself with two factors is something that's so important to me that we use it at Google all the time internally, and we make this capability available to our users as well. I want to now speak a little bit more on the safety side, but with regard to protections, technical initiatives that we can take to protect people. One thing which we might want to be protected from is spam. And for the moment, most of our protections are in the form of filtering. So Google, Gmail, and others try to figure out what's spam and what isn't and try to filter it out if you ask that it be done. I do wonder whether we will ever get to the point where we can have authenticated email. And if we could achieve the objective of having strong authentication for an email source, then you might decide to say, I don't want to see anything except strongly authenticated email. And anything else I'll consider spam, or I'll consider it second-class material. So filter everything that you believe is spam, put everything that is strongly authenticated over here, and the stuff in the middle I will look at on occasion. But we should be working towards tools that will allow us to ask for those kinds of services. We worry about viruses and worms and Trojan horses and things like that. These are all examples of some of the harms, some of the bad behaviors that we see in the internet. It wasn't in the original internet because it was a very homogeneous collection of engineers. They had no motivation for doing any of the things we see today. Once the general public is part of the internet environment, all of the good things and all the bad things about the general public, about us, show up on the network, and we have to do something about that. We can't ignore it. So being able to detect that viruses are present, or worms are present, or Trojan horses are present, or detecting that an intrusion has taken place, that someone is using the network in a way that wasn't intended, are all important tools for protecting us, whether we're in an enterprise context or a residential setting. Moreover, some of the tools that we use to use the network that have operating systems in them or have browsers running are also sources of weakness and vulnerability. And we have a responsibility, if we're going to build a safe network, to improve those operating systems, to improve the browsers. Most of the infections that occur, machines that become infected, are infected through browsers that are ingest software that it really shouldn't ingest and causes changes to the operating systems and creates zombie machines, which become part of botnets, which then get used to generate spam or produce denial of service attacks. So we need to work on better quality and maybe more paranoid operating systems and browsers. There's a recent development which I find quite attractive in this domain. When your machine first boots up, it runs something called BIOS, which is sort of the basic I/O system that boots in the operating system. That's a very vulnerable moment for any piece of computing equipment because it's basically pulling in the operational software. The National Security Agency, in partnership with industry, has now proposed, and the industry is responding, to have cryptographically validated BIOS software, which is firmware. And so before that program, which boots in the operating system, actually runs, the hardware checks to see whether it is digitally signed properly. And it won't run that boot program unless the digital checksum works out. Moreover, if you're going to update that BIOS program, it checks first to see whether the update is digitally signed properly. And if it isn't, it won't do the update. These are really combinations of hardware and software in order to improve the reduce, say, the vulnerability of a machine to becoming infected. And so having instituted this what I will call sharing of hardware and software protections, I think is a very powerful and extremely general purpose idea. This is operating at a very low level in the infrastructure of devices that use the internet. There are ways of detecting sites, websites that have become infected. When Google does the index of the World Wide Web, it sends crawlers out to download every single home page that it can find. And as the software is downloading those pages, it's looking to see whether there are any possible viruses or worms or Trojan horses. Now, it's a piece of software that's doing this, so it's not perfect. But if it detects what it believes is an infected website, it will mark that website as having potentially malicious software. If you use the Google search tool and it happens to pull up one of the websites that has this infection indication, if you try to go there by clicking on the link, a big red interstitial page comes up saying, you may not want to go there. We think that there's software that would infect your machine. We're not always correct. And some website holders are quite unhappy when they realize that they're being that their access to their websites are being intervened by this bright red warning page, and they often will complain. We send them to an organization called Stop Badware, which has spun out of the Harvard Berkman Center. They do the job of analyzing the websites and helping the website holder or responsible party to debug and remove any infecting software. Sometimes they'll say, I didn't put anything in there. Why are you pointing the finger at me? And the answer is, you didn't put anything there, but somebody else did because the security of your website wasn't sufficient to prevent someone from infecting that website. So this is another example of a protective move to make the network safer. There are other things that are happening in the technical space. The domain name system security extensions, which digitally sign entries in the domain name system, have been instituted for some time now. The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers is now signing the root zone of the domain name system, and that propagates downward into secondary and tertiary and so on zones of the domain name system. That's actually a very important tool. You can ask for a digitally signed response when you do a lookup in the domain name system, and that gives you increasing confidence that the internet address that's pointed to is in fact the same as the one that was put in there by the party who is responsible for that domain name. This may be extended in many other ways to allow installation of certificates in the domain name system as well, as opposed to relying solely on certificate authorities to identify a party using cryptographic means. There's more detail there, but I don't have time to go into that. I want to shift now. Remember, we're in this space of talking about a safe internet. What else could we do to make it safer? Well, there are legal protections that might also be needed in order to make the network safe. If you can't inhibit, through technical means, bad behavior and abuse of the net, you don't have a whole lot of other options. The other options tend to fall into the category of saying, we have agreed that these things are socially unacceptable, these behaviors are unacceptable, and if we catch you, there will be consequences. This is how we deal with a lot of abusive behavior. People drink and drive, and we say, don't do that, and they do it anyway, and they run into each other, or they harm themselves, or they harm property. And we say, well, if we catch you, there will be consequences. One could make the same argument for abusive behavior on the internet. Part of the problem is that the internet is global in scope, and the harms that might be visited upon a victim could come from anywhere on the internet, which means it could come from anywhere in the world, which means it could come across a national boundary. The implication of that is that if we are going to do anything about what we might collectively agree is unacceptable behavior on the net, then we're going to have some kind of international reciprocity. We're going to have treaty agreements about which behaviors we collectively believe are unacceptable and what we're willing to do about them. But in order to make this effective, it has to be a cooperative effort, in the same way that the internet doesn't work without the cooperation of all the various internet service providers that are interconnected with each other. Now, on a more positive note, with regard to legal protections, imagine that we decide that the digital signatures are an important element to have in place for e-commerce, so that people can essentially conclude contracts online. Now, the question will be, if we use all the tools for digital signatures and two parties agree on a contract and they each digitally sign this contract, the question then will be, when one of the parties breaches the agreement, how does the other party respond and what recourse does that party have? Well, if a digital signature does not have the same strength, legal strength, as a wet one does, when you try to remediate this breach, you may discover there's no legal support for it. So here again, we would need reciprocity. We would need to have agreements, for example, about what it means to issue a digital certificate, what actions have you taken to validate the party's identities before you issue the certificate so that the party can use a public and private key for digital signatures? What are the legal frameworks in which you can bring a complaint, and under what conditions will that complaint be heard and be given credibility on the basis of a signed digital contract? So here would be something that we could do that's constructive, because the intent is to improve our ability to perform electronic commerce. One thing that I worry a lot about any kind of discussion of legal protections in the internet is that there be due process associated with any actions that are taken. One should anticipate, expect equal treatment under the law. And once again, this is a complex matter because it's international in its character. But the idea that actions cannot be taken or will not be taken without due process, without proper notice, and without proper authority seems to me a very important element in any expectation of a safe network. We're all familiar, I think, with the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and we've heard from time to time about access to the internet being characterized as a human right. I have to admit to you that I find that an odd formulation in a way, to pick a particular technology and bind a human right to it. If the internet changes, which it almost assuredly will, one would wonder whether you have to rewrite the human rights. And here I think the internet is simply a manifestation of a set of more fundamental human rights about the ability to speak and be heard, the ability to be kept safe from harm. And so my tendency would be not to point at the internet and claim access to it as a human right, but rather say the human rights of expression and freedom to hear and the like are manifest in the internet and whatever it turns into. I do want to mention that there are a couple of other possible constructive things that we could do to make the internet safer. Some of you, I'm sure, know about the fire department, and you know that if there's a building on fire, that you have the ability to call the fire department and say there's a building on fire. The fire department has authority to do some fairly extreme things. If the building's on fire, it can break in the doors and the windows and into the roof, it can pour water into the building, it can do quite a bit of damage in the process of putting out the fire, and yet we accept that, because the danger of that building on fire is that other buildings nearby might also catch fire and people's property and lives might be at risk. We don't have a cyber fire department, but it occurs to me that something like that might be an interesting concept to pursue. Many of us are not in a position to put the fire out in the house. I mean, can you imagine standing in front of the house with your garden hose, realizing that you really want somebody there with a much bigger hose and a lot more water? Well, in the cyber fire, if you're under attack, your company is under attack, and you don't have the skills or the personnel or the equipment to respond, you might want somebody else to do that. Now, the question is, if we create such a notion of a cyber fire department, what authorities will it have? What is it permitted to do in the course of trying to defend against a cyber attack? And one question, of course, is can a competitor call the cyber fire department and have it attack his competitor? So we have to have some kind of rules that say when you can invoke the cyber fire department. But having access to better expertise to protect yourself seems like it would be an interesting idea. This also leads to the notion of forensics and improving of tools for forensics. If we're going to have an internet that is safer, then those who would abuse it and abuse its users need to be discoverable. And in order for that to happen, we need better forensic tools than we have today. Once again, I'd be very concerned about the question of privacy, confidentiality, and other rights and due process and so on. But we still need to accept that there are people who cause harm on the net who have to be found, and that we should be mindful of creating tools and methods and a legal framework in which that can be done. So let me stop there and simply say one more time that we say that the internet is for everyone, but it isn't yet. We say that it should be for everyone. I say it must be for everyone. And I hope it will be for everyone. Thank you very much. So we're going to do Q&A, but given the fact that I'm hearing impaired, you're going to have to put up with a Geraldo-style Q&A session. I have this microphone, which I will turn on, and if you raise your hand, I will come rushing down the aisle in the hope that I'll be able to read your lips if I need to. So here we go, and the first question is right there. This is working? Yes.
Hi, this is Sarah Freixa from Melbourne IT, and I was wondering, we were talking, or you were talking about privacy, calling for protection, and a safer internet. Are you concerned at all that this might change with the new GTLDs?
Well, that's an interesting question. First of all, let me distinguish between the internationalized domain names and the Latin domain names. I hope that the new GTLDs accommodate both, because I think people whose languages are not naturally expressible in Latin characters would appreciate the ability to express domain names in something other than Latin characters. I don't think that the new GTLDs are necessarily any more risky than the collection of domain names that we have today. If you look, there are 147 million domain names, apparently, and that's just at the second level, I think. So the believability, or how do you know what that domain name means, is no more and no less risky in the new GTLD world than it is in the existing domain name world. It's just that some of these are now at the top level domain, at top level as opposed to second level. So once again, we're back to something that I bet every one of us should be mindful of, and that is that we should be thinking more critically about our use of the internet than we sometimes do. If we believe that everything on the internet we hear and see is true, that's a mistake. If we're raising children, probably the best tool that we can teach them is critical thinking. They should be thinking about all the information they get. The internet is just sort of a stark example of the full range of content and misinformation and mistakes and so on, and maybe even deliberate errors. But we want our kids not only to be thoughtful about what they see on the internet, but we want them to be thoughtful about what they read in the newspapers, if they still read newspapers, or watch on television, or hear on the radio, or what they get from their friends or from their parents and their teachers. They should be thinking critically about all of that, including internet. So I think it's not any worse than it is now, but we can do better by thinking. Okay, let me get this gentleman over here and then I'll come back.
Thank you. The name is Eric. And I would like to point out to the book, The Filter Bubble, and it recently came out, and they pointed out some of Google's new tactics or strategies with regards to when someone does a search, that the results are tailored to that person and the data that's been gathered on that person. How much further can this go? Can it get into video when someone's using the video chat feature, for example, and there's image recognition of brands that they're wearing, or there's analysis of their facial expressions? And what do you foresee as to how far this kind of recording can be done?
That's a good question. So Google's actually been very cautious about any kind of facial recognition and other kinds of practices, although I gather that Facebook has just announced something that along those lines. The technology is there to do a lot of the things that you've described. And so as a society, I think we have a responsibility to try to say something about what those limits should be. And I'm taking from your question that you're engaged in that. Good for you. Keep working it. There are obvious situations where these techniques could be very useful. We're back into the question of harm, not just on the internet, but harm in the world we live in. But the question about when those tools get applied and under what conditions and with whom that information is shared is a very big question for me. It's not very different in some ways to the question about who should have access to medical information, just to pick another analogy. There are times when, let me give you a scenario. Let's suppose you're in a strange city, never been in before, and you have a medical emergency. At the moment that this emergency occurs and you're in the emergency room, probably, assuming you're still conscious, the last thought in your mind is keeping from the people who are trying to help you through this crisis, hiding medical information from them. You basically want them to know as much as possible so they can do the right thing for you to get through this medical emergency. On the other hand, you probably would not want it to be the case that the parties who had access to all of that information during the emergency will now have access to your medical files forever after that. What you would want is to have some sort of a finite time limit after which that access is no longer available. Credit cards have a similar element to them. They expire. So the idea of expiring privileges for access to certain kinds of information strikes me as being a pretty powerful notion that we might want to apply also to the things that you were talking about facial recognition or other kinds of recognition things. I have to admit to you that privacy is becoming pretty hard to come by. And I have one other personal anecdote that surprised me. Maybe it shouldn't have, but it did. There was a meeting in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And the security team said to me, I'm sorry, please don't take the car to get from the airport to Sao Paulo because there's only one road, and if there's a problem, you can't get off the road. I said, well, what's your suggestion? They said, take a helicopter. I said, well, that's okay with me. It only takes 12 minutes by helicopter instead of 2 hours in the car. So we took the helicopter from the airport. We landed in front of the hotel. And about 20 minutes later, somebody came up, tapped me on the shoulder, and said, you're on YouTube. I said, what do you mean I'm on YouTube? He said, well, somebody saw you landing in the helicopter and took a video of it and then put it up on YouTube. It was actually fairly amusing because the person who did this had no idea I was on the helicopter. He just thought it was cool the helicopter was landing. So he videoed the whole thing down, the helicopter lands, I get out, and you hear him say, that's Vince Cerf. Then he put it up on YouTube. So. And it was only 20 minutes or something. So what that tells me, told me anyway, is that here we are walking around with our cameras and our video recorders and our audio recorders and our radios and our texting capability and everything else. The ability to remain anonymous is almost evaporated at this point. Okay, thank you. Yes, right here.
June Klein, and I do some collaborative research with the Oxford Internet Institute, specifically on the Fifth Estate. I have two questions about that. Oh, sure.
Just you're covering your mouth.
Oh.
I can't never
use a microphone. Oh. Okay. I'm June Klein, and okay. Anyway, I have two questions related to the Fifth Estate. First, I find it very curious that with all the type of people who are here and at other conferences like this in the United States, that nobody's mentioned the Fifth Estate. Whereas when you go abroad, everybody seems to understand what it is. And I find that very, very curious. Second thing is if you take clear-cut examples of the Fifth Estate, such as I paid a bribe.com in India, and which was just, you know, it was just showcased on BBC Radio. And apparently they've been pretty successful at it as well. They have made some changes. And then you look at WikiLeaks and you look at Arab Spring. And the question is, what do you think the reaction will be in terms of internet public policy? Are you going to see more kill switches, or are you going to see more of a backlash that I want a bigger role of the internet?
So that's a very interesting question. Remember, you've asked an engineer a political question, so you deserve the answer that you get. First of all, any regime that believes that it can only survive by hiding information from the population is going to be threatened by the technology that we've been talking about today. And so there will be certain places where there will be very strong negative reactions to freedom of speech and everything else. It's no surprise you understand that. I also at least hope, I won't say I know, but I will say I hope that we are able to retain an internet that does keep this freedom and openness and ability to create transparency from evaporating. Now, the kill switch, let's refer specifically to the Egyptian case for a concrete example. The kill there was to kill the underlying transport. Internet packets are not magic. They have to be carried on something. The fact that they don't care what they're carried on is important because it allows us to use lots of different technology to implement the motion of internet packets from one place to another. But if there is nothing to carry them, they won't go anywhere. And so shutting down the underlying transport is one way of killing the internet. What I believe would happen, however, if that were to go on for any appreciable period of time, that people would bring in radios, they would do mesh networking, there would be a variety of inventions or implementations to overcome that. These are not new technologies. This is entirely doable today. I have a mesh network running in my house. It's an IPv6 sensor network. And it keeps track of the temperature and humidity and so on. Every 5 minutes, I get a little report that goes into a server down in the rack in the basement. And twice a day, I get a little note saying, what's the status of my my house? Unless the temperature goes up above 60 degrees in the wine cellar, in which case I get an SMS emergency message. So this is a mesh technology. And I think a population whose ability to speak and hear is being suppressed will find ways to bring technology in order to redress that weakness. So I hope that the internet will, I like to say that IP runs over everything, including you if you're not paying attention to what's going on. Okay, let me get this gentleman, then we'll go here and then I'll go over there.
Hi. Yes, Jeremy Pesner, self-affiliated. There's been a lot of to-do about IPv4 versus IPv6. That's a very clear example of how the internet needs to evolve to survive today. I guess what I'm curious is, having seen literally the lifetime of the internet, what other sorts of shortcomings and issues and pitfalls need to be addressed in order to keep it evolving and vibrant for how it's being used today and in the future?
Plainly, the address space is one limitation, and that's what the V6 is all about. Another one is this thing I talked about earlier, strong authentication, two-factor authentication, and things like that. What we want, or what I want anyway, is the ability to ask for you to strongly identify yourself when I ask you to do that. You have the freedom to say, no, I won't, in which case I'll say this conversation is over. But the idea that we have tools available for that purpose is absolutely essential. I think that for internet to continue to grow, we're going to see another dimension expanding. In Europe, you hear the term Internet of Things. Here in the United States, you hear about the smart grid. I believe that there are going to be billions of devices on the network, and getting those devices fully interconnected with everything else on the net is a very important step in the direction of making the net more useful. At the same time, that poses risks, because if every appliance in your house is accessible on the internet, what happens if the 15-year-old next door reprograms your house while you're away? So once again, we're back to strong authentication being a very important element in making this expanding internet a safe place in which to build new applications. Apart from that, there are We have not made very good use of broadcast media in the internet. So if you're looking for another technical avenue for expansion, I can hardly wait to start getting services in satellites that literally broadcast internet packets to hundreds of millions of receivers all at the same time. We've been doing that for years with television, but what I want is the ability to carry any form of digital information in packet form from a satellite down to hundreds of millions of receivers. It's a very efficient way of delivering a large amount of the same information. And I don't want to be limited anymore to simply delivering audio or video. I want the ability to deliver anything that I can digitize and packetize. That's a step which I hope is taken, because it would be another platform on top of which you could build some very interesting applications. There's more, but I'll stop there. Let's see, I had this gentleman back here, and then I'll get to Julie. And then I'll go over there.
My name is John Gilberg. I'm with Blue Fountain Media. You've spoken very eloquently about the future of the web. If you can put yourself back in your 1990 shoes, Is the web of 2011 anything like you could have imagined, or any parts of it like you might have imagined?
Oh, of course. I mean, everything's happening exactly the way we imagined it would. I mean, you know, what do you... So really, if you, let's go all the way back. Let's go to 1973. Bob Kahn and I are sitting here. He comes to Stanford and he says, I have a problem. I said, what's your problem? He says, well, I got three different kinds of packet switch nets and I have to hook them together somehow. And that's what we worked on for about 6 months. That's what the TCP/IP protocols were all about. So you might say, well, you know, did you do that in a vacuum? And the answer is no. Did you understand how powerful this kind of technology could be? The answer was yes. Did we know all the applications that people would invent? No. But 1973 is a really interesting year, so I want you to really appreciate the context. 1973, I was at Stanford University, Bob Kahn was at DARPA, and Xerox PARC was around the corner from my lab at Stanford. In May of 1973, Bob Metcalf invents the Ethernet. In 1971 or 72, email gets invented on the ARPANET. In 1968, Doug Engelbart is talking about hyperlinks and, you know, the knowledge society and knowledge works, and he builds a one-node system which you could characterize as kind of a single computer World Wide Web. I mean, I don't mean to do any disservice to my friend over Tim over there, but the idea of being groups of people sharing information in a common environment is what Doug was so excited about. But he invented the mouse, he invented the portrait mode display, he invented the linking of things from one file to another in that machine. It was called the online system. Now, all of this is available to Bob and to me as we're thinking about how do we build this internet piece. So, in some sense, we had a very strong sense of the power of all this. Even social networking became visible as a consequence of the networked email. The first email distribution list was sci-fi lovers. That's engineers, what do you expect? A bunch of geeks. And then the next one was Yum Yum, if I'm remembering right, which was a distribution list of restaurant reviews coming out of Stanford. So engineers are, you know, interested in science fiction and they like food. So it's not a surprise that you would see those two things. But you could see the power of the distribution list. So, honestly, I think we had a sense of a lot of power, but I don't think we knew what would happen when 2 billion people got online. And the particular thing which astonished me more than anything was when Tim's capability became widely available, the willingness of people to pour a huge amount of information into the net simply for the joy of knowing it might be useful to somebody else. There wasn't any obvious remunerative mechanism. They just wanted to know that what they were doing might be useful to someone else, or maybe someone else would be interested in the same thing they are, and they would then get to know them and get to work together. So the astonishing thing about the web is this outpouring of content, and of course it continues today. Can I do one more?
Thank you, Julie Rones, and I'm a member of the DC chapter of the Internet Society and a lawyer. And I'm wondering your thought about authentication. You cited the credit card companies as being an example of how that was achieved in a different context. Do you have any recommendations as to who would pay for this or how that would be achieved, looking at the potential of the cost benefit, but would the businesses pay for that? Would end users, would it be a collaboration, or have you given that some thought?
Yes. So strong authentication involves the ability to generate, to use cryptographic pairs and to both sign things and encrypt or decrypt them. And the scenario that I wish I could persuade the banks to undertake goes the following. Today we use credit cards with these little magnetic strips on them. They are not very secure. It's possible to actually fabricate a card by using a hot iron and some more metal oxide tape. So ideally, oh, what have I just done? You know. Yeah, it's okay, it's just geeks, right? And besides, if you Google it, you'll find it on the net anyway. Okay, so my proposition is that if the bank said, look, we really want you to have this smart card that has the ability to generate cryptographic authenticity, because it will allow us not only to protect the use of the card, but also offer services that we would not be willing to offer on the basis of the magnetic strip card because of the stronger authentication. If they said, by the way, you can't get any money out of the ATMs if you don't have one of these cards, everybody would get one of the cards. They would get, because 90% of all the cash that is dispensed in the U.S. anyway is through an ATM machine now, not the tellers. So if everybody had such a card and the teller machines had readers in order to implement the proposition, then that would form an infrastructure that would make it of interest to people building devices, whether it's personal computers or laptops or notebooks, to be able to sense those cards. Or maybe you would use near-field communication, or might use a physical contact on the card. But the point here is that once that infrastructure is in place, you begin to use it for a variety of other applications. So the problem is getting to the point where there's a rationale, a motivation for getting these smart card-like capabilities in place. And I submit to you that we are not very far away from there, given the set of risks that we're all starting to see. So I'm hoping that if the bank scenario that doesn't hold up, maybe another one will. I know I'm not wearing it now, but I carry around a two-factor cryptographic generator as part of my ID at Google. I can't use the internal systems at Google without it. And if we all begin to think in those terms, maybe we will create the incentive to do that. So I have to stop here. I'll turn this over to Sally again.
There you go.